So I think, yeah, I'm amplified. Thanks, Miriam. I'm not sure any of those things are really true, but it's nice of you to say them.
Good evidence.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, we'll see. We'll see how things go. Your judgment may change in the next half hour. So my name is Dave Ragsdale. I'm a neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute. And of course, this is a workshop on graduate supervision. And like everybody else here, I've been a graduate student, and I've supervised graduate students. And I've also was for 4 years the associate director of the integrated program in neuroscience, which is a fairly large graduate program at McGill. So, you know, I have my own experiences with graduate supervision. But one of the things I want to, you know, emphasize right from the start is that, you know, I've participated in quite a few of these faculty development workshops now over the years. And what I've found, and I think the other members of the faculty development team would agree with me, that what's really valuable about these workshops is not listening to some person stand in the front of the room and tell you things, even though that's what I'm going to do for the next half hour. But what's really valuable is the fact that there's a lot of expertise in this room, right? And it's the shared expertise. It's our ability to share our experiences and talk to each other. And there aren't that many opportunities for us to do that, really, I think. So this is a special opportunity for us to get together, talk, and learn from each other. And I think you'll see that that's especially true when we break into the small groups. That's where I think most of the learning really takes place. And it takes place because we all have some experiences that we can share with each other. So I'm obligated to say, for reasons that I still don't understand, even though it's done at every single one of these things, that I don't have any conflict of interest. So I just should get that out of the way right away. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the goals of the workshop. So I think that my idea is that there's two sort of overarching themes that I want to develop. And the first is that graduate students are important to us. They're valuable, right? Because we have labs and we need people to work in the labs, and graduate students are well suited for that role. They're comparatively cheap, right? We don't have to pay them as much as we pay, for example, a postdoc. They're enthusiastic and they're smart. And most of us are paying our students, at least some of our students, at least partially off of our grants. So there's a feeling that we have that we're paying these people and that we expect something from them, right? We need them to get work done in the labs, and we expect that they're going to work up to a certain standards. And to some extent, that's reasonable. But one of the ideas I want to develop in this workshop is that we also have an ethical responsibility to treat them as students, and a pedagogical responsibility to treat them as students, right? We are helping these people to develop from what they are when they enter the lab, undergraduate students, people who've gotten very, very good at sitting in a chair, listening to someone give a lecture, and then regurgitate the information on that lecture in an exam, to people who can actually develop knowledge themselves and think for themselves. And that's an ethical responsibility that we have. And I think one of the ideas I want to develop is that it's important for us to take that responsibility seriously in all its aspects. And the second sort of related idea is that if we do that, and if we do it well, we'll sustain the energy and enthusiasm that our students have when they enter graduate programs, and the outcomes will be better for us. So the idea is that, you know, if we do this well, we'll be doing our jobs properly, we'll be treating the students, the graduate students, as students, the way they ought to be treated, and the outcomes for us will be better. That's the first idea, the first goal of the workshop. And the second idea that I want to develop, or the second goal, is that in spite of our best efforts, problems do develop. We do have, there are interpersonal problems, there are problems that are related to the way students work in the labs and all kinds of things like that. And I want us to try and develop some strategies for dealing with the kinds of problems that invariably develop in our relationships with graduate students. Because of all of our pedagogical relationships, this one is the most complex, right? You go and you teach a class, you stand in front of the class and you talk for a while and then you go back to your office and your interaction is over. But your relationship with a graduate student is intimate and it lasts for a long time. So this is by far the most complex pedagogical relationship that we have at the university. So I want to start by getting some input from you, okay? And what I'd like to do is simply to ask you to, you can just put your hand up or just shout out what you think are some of the skills that you would expect a graduating PhD to have. So I'm opening it up to you. Yeah.
Critical thinking.
Critical thinking, yeah. Critical thinking is, I think, one of the most important ones, yeah.
Technical competence.
Yes. Yeah.
Communication skills.
Excellent, yeah.
Independence.
Pardon?
Independence.
Independence. That's fantastic. Those are, I'll show you in a minute how prescient you guys all are, yeah. Pardon?
Resourcefulness,
yeah.
Think like somebody in their discipline.
To be able to think like someone in their discipline, yeah, yeah.
Curiosity.
And curiosity. I'm going to stop you there because that's fantastic because what I'm going to show you is that there is, of course, a literature on graduate supervision. And if you look at the literature, the literature talks about the kinds of things that a graduating PhD ought to have, and though they're exactly the things that you guys have mentioned. So here's a paper that shows some of the ideas of some of the attributes that a graduating student ought to have, a graduating PhD student ought to have. So the very things that you guys have highlighted. They have something to say that their scientific peers want to hear. They have technical competence. They're able to communicate effectively. They have independence, right? So these are some of the kinds of ideas that we see in the literature about what graduating PhDs ought to possess. And here's from a different publication. They're educated to think and solve problems inventively. We talked about, I think that someone might have mentioned that, creativity and curiosity. And they're broad-based. And this is one of the issues that comes up, I think, that we've all experienced with graduate students, is that they learn a certain kind of technical competence, but they're not able to think broadly within their fields. And this is one of the challenges that we confront. So I think you all have a good sense of the kinds of things that we expect from a graduating PhD.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I actually think number three is a bit amusing, to say that we expect them to effectively communicate to non-experts, because I actually find that most of my colleagues are incapable of communicating.
Right. Well, that's a really, I think that that's a good point. That's an interesting point. And I don't know, we could probably have a long discussion on that, but I suspect we, you know, that it's becoming more and more important that we are able to effectively communicate with non-experts, because increasingly we are being asked to justify what we do. And even though we're confident that what we do is important and justifiable, it's not always easy to translate that to non-experts. And so I think you're right. I think that that's a special kind of skill. So really, you can kind of summarize all of these specific ideas that we've talked about by saying we want them to be creators of knowledge, not just consumers of knowledge. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about it, right? Because that's what a graduating undergraduate is. It's a consumer of knowledge. They have classes, and they have textbooks, and they listen to lectures, and they learn things, and then they regurgitate those things on an exam, and they think that's what knowledge is. And the process of graduate training is the process of transforming that kind of a thinker. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, after all, we need to acquire knowledge before we can create knowledge. But we want to transform these undergraduates who are acquiring knowledge into people who can actually create new knowledge. And that's quite a challenge, right? That's quite a pedagogical challenge for us. So what do the students expect from us? Well, I think they expect, of course, that we know what we're doing, right? That's one of the first things that they expect, that we, in fact, have the technical and scientific competence to train them effectively. And they also expect that we're going to be reasonable people. And they expect that we're going to be understandable and approachable, right? That they're going to be able to come and talk to us about problems. So this is what comes out of the literature. Now, there's part of the genesis or part of the of this workshop or part of the origins of this workshop were surveys that were done of faculty at McGill by graduate studies, graduate students at McGill by graduate studies, and graduate students in the integrated program of neuroscience, right? So I'm not gonna give you any information about what the results of those surveys were in the context of supervisors. That's sort of integrated into the presentation. But I want to give you some sense of what the students had to say. And what I've done is I've cherry-picked some of the comments from students to sort of highlight what McGill students think about us, right? And of course, some of the things they think about us are wonderful. They think that some of the comments that we got back from students were, it's great, everything's fantastic, but of course that wouldn't be very entertaining. So here are some comments from graduate students. And one of the comments that I encountered, so I've looked through all of these comments, right? And one of the comments that I encounter over and over again is that the experience is almost entirely determined by the supervisor. And this, in fact, is supported by the literature on graduate supervision. We play a huge role in whether or not the graduate experience is going to be a constructive, effective one for students, or whether it's going to be a miserable one, right? Or whether the lab is going to turn out to be an example of a concentration camp, right? So we play an important role. And the students... initial enthusiasm for science is crushed by the force of personalities of their supervisors, right? So I think this is a kind of comment I get a lot from in the surveys as well, that the students are saying, I came in and I was all excited, and by the time I finished, I was miserable. Another thing that, interestingly, a lot of students said in the surveys from graduate studies and from the integrated program in neuroscience was that supervisors need more training and that this should be mandatory, right? Now, to me, when I read those kinds of comments, on the one hand, they strike me as a little bit condescending, right? Like, I mean, who are these graduate students to tell us that we need training? On the other hand, I think that they're touching on something that's important about our understanding of graduate supervision, and that is that none of us have any formal training, or as far as I know. I mean, maybe there are some exceptions in this room, but most of the biomedical researchers who I know have really no formal training in graduate supervision. In fact, one of the things that amazed me when I became an assistant professor was I wasn't trained in anything except how to push the buttons on the machines that I used to do the experiments that I did, right? I didn't know how to manage a lab, I didn't know how to manage a budget, and I didn't know how to manage graduate students. And one way of putting that is that all of us have our own experiences as graduate students, and what we tend to do is to simply transfer those experiences into our own graduate supervision practices, right? So we say to ourselves, we either say it explicitly or more likely it's implicit, right? It's something that never really comes into consciousness. It's just we operate in a certain way as supervisors, and the way that we operate is based on our own personal experiences. And those experiences, of course, are very, very limited. And that's one of the reasons why a workshop like this is a good thing, right? Because we all have unique experiences, and we can bring those experiences together and learn from each other. But I think we can all agree that basing our own supervision merely on how we were supervised is probably not the most effective way of approaching this responsibility, this challenge. So if you look at the literature in graduate supervision, they break supervision down into a number of different roles, and I've indicated some of them here: role model, mentor, coach, critic, and facilitator of progress, sponsor, and cheerleader. So what I'd like to do next is I'm just going to go through these different roles quickly and just talk a little bit about each of the roles. I think we all know, I'm putting terms onto things that we all know that we do or know that we ought to do implicitly. But in any case, it helps us to sort of make these things explicit so we can talk about them. So the first thing I want to talk about is this idea of the role model and mentor. And there's two important ideas here. And the first one is that there is a difference between being a role model and being a mentor. Now, once again, this is just terminology. It's just assigning words to ideas that are already out there and that we're already aware of. Nevertheless, to make these ideas explicit, there's a difference between being a role model and a mentor. And the important thing to remember is that we are role models whether we like it or not. We're role models if we do things well, and we're role models when we do things poorly, right? So our role as role models is inescapable. So if a student gives you a paper or a thesis chapter to read, and we sit on it for 3 months, we're acting as role models. If we are unhappy because a certain experiment didn't work and we berate a student because we're frustrated and angry, we're acting as a role model. And it's plausible that those students are, in addition to affecting how they feel as graduate students, that role modeling is going to impact them, and they're going to go on and act the same way when they are independent investigators on their own. So the idea of the role model is we're role models, and we have to deal with that. We have to accept the fact that everything we do for better and worse is impacting our students and affecting how they perceive the role of the graduate supervisor. Being a mentor is something a little more subtle and complex, right? So you're not necessarily a mentor to all of your graduate students, and you may be a mentor to a student that's not a student that's under your supervision. I think all of us here, since we are all reasonably successful, we've all made it to this point in our careers, probably have mentors that we could point to. Mentors are people who really care about our development and our progress, and whose concern for us may extend beyond their formal role as a supervisor, right? So for example, my postdoctoral supervisor helped me to sort of integrate me into the scientific community by letting me go to conferences that he was invited to and he didn't have time to go to. He helped me to write my first grant application, and he gave me feedback on my first grant application. So a mentor is a more complex role. And I think that we all should hope that we act as mentors at least sometimes, because being a mentor is a rewarding relationship and one that we should all aspire to have with at least some of our students, or with at least some of the students in our graduate program. Now, the second role I want to talk about is the role as coach. And my interpretation of coach, this is really about our pedagogical role, right? So we have a responsibility to educate our students, right? And the challenge for us, I think, is that responsibility extends beyond just showing them which buttons to push and which knobs to turn to run the electrophysiological setup or the PCR machine or whatever. And I think you all are familiar with this experience, and I think this is especially true with master's students. It's not uncommon to have, say, a thesis seminar or an advisory committee meeting with a master's student and discover that the student knows a great deal about their project in a very, very narrowly defined way, right? They know technically how to do the experiments and how to analyze the experiments on the computer, but they don't understand how to integrate those ideas into the larger concepts of the field. And I think that we would all agree that's not what we want from our students if they go on and get PhDs. We want them to have an ability to integrate their own narrowly defined project into a larger field. And I think the important idea here is that involves more than just inserting them into the laboratory and teaching them how to do specific things. We need to be open to their interest in classwork, their interest in attending seminars, and facilitate and encourage their interest in reading the literature in the field and all these kinds of things. And I think we all know this. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I just think that it's important for us to keep these things in mind, because one of the things that we, for example, encounter in the neuroscience graduate program are students who say, my supervisor won't let me do anything. My supervisor tells me not to study for exams because he says they're not important, right? My supervisor won't let me go to seminars because he says they're a waste of time and they're taking me away from the lab, right? And the idea I want to get across is that's inappropriate, and that's acting inappropriately as supervisors. We have a broad responsibility to educate our students as scientists. So I like this idea that as coaches we have two sort of complementary roles, and one is to break down the tasks that the students are doing into manageable chunks, And then the second role is to help the student to reassemble those chunks into a meaningful whole. There's a set of concepts in educational literature, right? So this just doesn't apply to graduate supervision, but in educational literature in general. And the three terms that are associated with these concepts are modeling, scaffolding, and fading. You've probably heard of these. You may have heard of these terms before. The idea is we model appropriate behavior, whether it's writing a paper or conducting an experiment. And then we let the student do the work, but we scaffold them. And the idea of scaffolding is if you just throw the student into the lab and say, do this, they are not going to get very far. Or if you just say, go write a paper, but you don't give them any instruction, they're not going to get very far. So we provide a scaffold that enables them to get farther than they could get on their own. And then we gradually fade away, right? So the scaffolding gets sort of disassembled and the student can do the work on their own. Now, these ideas are obvious. But what I think is important is that when you talk to students and when you talk to supervisors, one of the major sources of conflict and tension is the details of how this process plays out. So what we see, for example, in comments from students is, my supervisor doesn't provide enough guidance. My supervisor doesn't help me enough. My supervisor doesn't tell me what I need to do. When we look at the comments from supervisors, what we see is, my student is too needy. My student doesn't have enough independence. My student needs too much guidance, right? So there's a tension there that creates conflict between supervisors and students. And I'll talk a little in a few minutes about maybe some strategies for dealing with that kind of tension, right? In a sense, that's two sides of the same coin. I think both the students and the supervisors often have legitimate points. They're just coming at it from a different perspective. So we also have a role as critics, and in this context, the word critic, I think, mainly refers to providing effective feedback. And this is one of the two biggest areas of student complaints about supervisors, that they're not getting effective and timely feedback from their supervisors. So this is a really important area that we need to think about and work on. Now, the faculty development team actually puts on a workshop on feedback. And in your folders, there is, oh yeah, these are some comments from students, right? So these are typical, again, I cherry-picked these comments, right? But these are the kinds of things students say. He was not satisfied with the progress of my work, but at the same time could not provide any guidance. You know what I mean? So there's a sense of frustration on the part of the students that they're not getting effective feedback. So in your folders, there is a piece of paper, two-sided. You don't have to look at it now. You can if you want. But it provides guidelines for feedback. And these guidelines come from the workshop that we give on feedback. And I think it's a pretty good guide to providing feedback. I've just highlighted some of the key ideas here in these slides. Right. So there's some general pieces of advice and some specific pieces of advice, and you can look at it at your leisure. But I think this gives us some good suggestions on how to provide effective feedback, right? So some of this stuff is obvious, like discuss and clarify mutual expectations and diagnose where the student is at, right? So these are things that we need to do. Some things are perhaps less obvious, but I think are important. One is that we should focus on one skill or behavior at a time, right? So one of the things that I know I do sometimes that's a mistake is I overload students with too much information. I give them too much feedback, and then they just get overwhelmed and they can't deal with it. So the literature on feedback suggests that giving feedback on a specific topic or on specific topics one at a time is a more effective strategy than just dumping a huge amount of information on them. And then there was a comment from one of the students in that thing where the student said, my supervisor wants me to do better, but he doesn't tell me how, and then we just get frustrated. And this is typical of the kinds of comments we get from students. And one of the ways that people give feedback that's not effective is they say, you know, you're not doing this right. This isn't working. You've got to fix it, right? So that's not effective feedback. We need to give feedback to our students that they can actually act on. We need to tell them not just that things aren't going well, but that here's the strategy for change. And then here's some other things. It should be behavioral. It should be immediate, not delayed. That's the other big thing, right? The biggest complaint that we get from students about feedback is that it comes too late, right? And there's the literature on feedback clearly indicates that feedback is effective when it's given in a timely fashion. And the students don't necessarily understand all of the things that we have to do. So they give us a paper to read, and then they don't get it back for 6 weeks, and then they get angry, and they don't realize that we're not just sitting around looking at the paper saying, you know, I don't feel like reading this today, that we're actually doing lots of other things. Nevertheless, we need to be aware that the longer things drag out, the less effective the feedback becomes. I think this is an interesting one. It says, include I messages. And this is something that I have to really think about when I give feedback to students, right? It's more effective if you say something like, I think this is how you need to, or this is what's wrong in this situation, rather than this is what you're doing wrong, or this is what your problem is. So if you say, I think, then you're saying, this is my opinion. You've got your own opinion. Let's have a discussion. If you say you are, then you're just basically labeling them and you're boxing them into a corner. So it's more effective to create that kind of dynamic rather than trying to tell the student what their problems are. Okay, so we're also cheerleaders, right? We need to encourage our students. And I think that we recognize that our graduate students typically enter our graduate programs with lots of enthusiasm and lots of energy. They think, I'm going to be a scientist. This is really, really exciting. And very often what we discover several years into the process is that enthusiasm has just shriveled up into nothing, right? They feel beaten down and defeated. And that's really a shame, right? Mm-hmm. Because we should be we should be taking advantage of that enthusiasm rather than snuffing it out. So monitor of student progress. Now this is something I think that this is kind of a two-edged sword. This is important. There's a lot of, in the surveys of supervisors, there are lots of complaints about the monitoring process, the forms, right, that we have to fill out every year for the students. And but there's a couple things that I want to say about that. And the first is that what we found in the neuroscience graduate program is that advisory committee meetings are really, really valuable and really important. And they're important because, for a lot of reasons, they're important because they're monitoring, encouraging student progress, keeping students on track. They're also important because they're bringing other people into the process. So we have, in most programs, not all programs at McGill, but most programs have advisory committees for their graduate students. And by having these meetings, we bring other people into the process. So when tensions emerge, if it's just the supervisor and the student, those tensions become very personalized. Whereas if a committee is involved, then that sort of spreads out the responsibility. If a student has got a problem with a certain behavior or a certain thing that they're doing, and it's a committee decision that is a problem, that has a very different effect on the student than if it's the supervisor. It's not a personalized issue. What we find in the neuroscience program is that supervisors often discourage their students from having committee meetings. And what they say is, well, you don't have enough data. It's a waste of time. You know, you shouldn't be doing this. But what our policy is that the advisory committee meeting is not really so much evaluative. It's meant to provide guidance and support to the student. So the committees are important from the student's point of view, but they're also important from our point of view, and here's why. Because we all know that some students don't thrive and don't succeed. And we've had numerous situations in our program where we have supervisors either coming to us or going to their students and saying, you know, you've been here 2 years and you haven't gotten anywhere. I've had it. You're gone. You're out. I want you out of the lab in 3 months. And you just can't do that. You can't go up to a student and say, it's not working out. You have to leave. And so what's happened here is, so then the students come to us and they say, my supervisor says he's kicking me out of the lab in 2 months because my project isn't working. And then we say, when is the last time you had an advisory committee meeting? And they say, oh, I've never had one, right? And the problem with that, aside from the negligence involved there, the problem is that there's no paper trail that this student was having problems. So if you have an advisory committee meeting, there's a form, one of the forms. On the form, You circle a box that says either the student passed the meeting or failed the meeting. If the student fails the meeting, that's a failure. And that is a failure just as if they failed a class. You can, I believe in our program, Josephine can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we ask that they hold a sec, if they fail one committee meeting, we ask that they hold another meeting within, say, 4 months? Within 4 months, right? So, you know, so they're given a timeline, they're given objectives, and then we say, you need to have another meeting within 4 months. If they fail that meeting, they now have two failures. Now you have a paper trail and you have a justification for dismissing the student from the program. So the advisory committee meetings protect us as well as the students. And so if you're having problem students, it's really important that you have this documentation that they're not thriving and succeeding in the lab, rather than just waiting until it becomes an out-of-control problem and then getting frustrated and telling the students they have to leave, because that won't work. It's not permitted. Okay. So we also, of course, have a role as a sponsor, and sponsor means that there are students, but it also means, it means that there are students, it means that, in a sense, we're the bosses, and it means that we're paying them, right? And so this is the role as sponsor, I think, is the greatest source of problems and tensions. And the main problem is the lack of clearly defined expectations. So again, we have lots of students come to us and say things like this. We have a family reunion down in Texas, and I've been going to this family reunion every year for the last 20 years since I was, 3 years old, and I told my supervisor that I'm going, and he says I can't go because we're working on an important paper right now, and he says, I took a vacation 2 months ago, but he never told me what the rules about vacations were in the first place, right? And so now we have this conflict. And of course, that you can imagine other scenarios as well, but the thing that happens is that the expectations about vacations, expectations about work hours, expectations about working on weekends, expectations about publications, none of these things are worked out in advance. It's all ad hoc. And so then when it comes to crunch time, there's a conflict between the supervisors and the students, and this is a big problem. Now, one of the ways that we've addressed this in the integrated program in neuroscience is that when a supervisor accepts a student, it's all done electronically in our program. So you click on the student and you say, I want this student. You get the IPN letter of agreement. And this is just, obviously you can't read this on the screen, but it's just to kind of show you. And I think you have, in fact, I'm almost positive, you have a copy of the IPN agreement in your folders. So this is an example of an agreement. And what this agreement does is, among other things, it outlines, first of all, the responsibilities of the student, the responsibilities of the supervisor, and the responsibilities of the program. So those are clearly defined. Then it has a section for the student and the supervisor to fill out together that defines these various issues: work hours, vacation, publication issues, if the student needs some kind of remedial classroom work. All of these things are defined in advance. Now, of course, there's a couple things about this. First of all, this needs to be worked out together. You can't write up something, hand it to the student, and say, take it or leave it. It needs to be worked out with the student, what the rules are. Secondly, this isn't a legal document, right? It's never been taken to court. So it's not that kind of document. I don't think any of us would want it to be that kind of document. But it nevertheless is something that both parties can point at if there's a conflict. If the supervisor and the student come to us and saying, we're having difficulties with this issue, we can get out the agreement and say, this is what you guys agreed to in the first place. And so they both can look at that, and then it helps us to resolve problems. Here's another example. This is a more personalized example. This comes from a guy named Tom Gleason, who's in civil engineering. And I found this on the graduate GPS website. So I take a look at this one, too. It's actually quite good. So this one is more personalized, right? And what he does is he writes out very nicely what the students should expect from him and what he expects from them and what their sort of mutual goals and expectations ought to be, and then has some places where they can fill in the details. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is the process for dealing with student problems. In spite of our best efforts, things can go wrong and students can give us problems. Now, at IPN, we have a process for dealing with student problems. And I think that just a couple things I'll say about this process. And the first is that one of our main pieces of advice to people about problems is deal with them early, right? Again, a lot of times we have students or supervisors coming to us and saying, this is a huge problem. My student is, there's something terrible going on with my student, or there's something terrible going on with my supervisor. And then we discover that this has been going on for 2 years, right? And now it's reached the point where there's no possibility of a pleasant or a resolution that anyone is happy with, right? And if they had dealt with this problem early on, things would have gone a lot better. And the second thing is we suggest that people try to deal with these problems at the lowest possible level, right? If this thing percolates up to the level of the Associate Dean of Graduate Studies, now all of a sudden things get kind of messy and ugly. And the third thing that we suggest is that if there's a conflict between supervisor and student, they need to bring somebody in from the outside. In our program, we have what's called an administrative mentor. So every student is assigned an administrative mentor. Now, the administrative mentor isn't a mentor in the way that I described earlier. It's more just a formal relationship that is assigned to the student. And the mentor has an administrative role. But also, if there's a problem, if there's a conflict, one of the mentor's responsibilities or roles is to become involved, not to become involved, but to participate in the resolution of that conflict. So bringing an external person in, into the advisory committee, an advisory committee, or an external mentor is really important in helping to resolve these problems. The other thing that we tell people over and over and over again when there's a problem, especially if it's a problem with the research, is have an advisory committee meeting, right? So if there's a conflict, the supervisor is saying the student's not getting anywhere, the student says, I'm trying hard, but this is a bad project, we say have an advisory committee meeting, right? Because that really helps a lot. Last thing I want to say is that, you know, everywhere I've been as a graduate student, a postdoc, and here at McGill, I have encountered graduate students who had serious problems with depression, problems with aggressive or violent behavior, problems with erratic behavior, you know, really serious problems. And I just want to point out that, if something like that comes up, one of the main resources at McGill to go to is the Office of the Dean of Students. And again, I think in your folders you have a handout that comes from the Office of the Dean of Students that describes how to deal with problem students. So here's the website. This is a place to go if you've got a student that's depressed or hasn't shown up in 3 months or is acting aggressively or towards you or towards other students in the lab. So to summarize, I think for me, you know, I've written some things down here, but the real thing I want to say in summary is that it's just really important for us to always keep in mind that our graduate students are students and to treat them that way. Okay? And that's it. So if there are any, that's all. If there are any questions at this point, I'd be happy to take them. We've just got a couple minutes, and then I want to say, there's one more thing I want to tell you, and this is important. What we're going to do next is we're going to go into these small groups, and we're going to do these scenarios. Now, I'm almost positive that there's not one person in this room who has more trepidation about participating in a scenarios than me. Right? I mean, and what I've done these things several times. And the first time I thought I was going to do this, I thought, this is terrifying. I'd rather shave my head with a cheese grater or something like that than do this, right? But what I've discovered is they're actually really fun, right? And what's really useful about this is that, you know, if we do a scenario about an abusive supervisor, what happens is it kind of gets us energized and focused. So then when we have a discussion, the discussion is much more dynamic and interesting and exciting, much more so than it would be if we just said, okay, if we all got into the room and said, okay, now we're going to talk about abusive supervisors, or now we're going to talk about feedback. So my suggestion, and I think I'm repeating what Miriam said, is what you really need to do here is just embrace the process and get into it. And I think if you do that, you'll really find that this is a lot of fun and you'll really enjoy it. Okay, so I'll stop there. Are there any comments or questions at this point?
Dave?
Yes. Oh, hi, yes.
Thank you very much very informative presentation.
Thank you.
Just a question with regard to that agreement.
Yeah.
I mean, why was it felt that you have to have such a contract? I mean, it's written in the form of a contract with the yeah. skimming through it that's consistently defined for the students and the supervisor of these issues. Although it's also defined by the university at some level and by the departments at another level.
I think you know, there are two parts of that contract, and the first part just outlines the responsibilities of the student, the supervisor, and the program. Now, as you indicate, that information is available elsewhere. It's just put in one place so that everybody can see it, and of course, probably they don't read it anyway. But the important part of that document, I think, is the part where the student and the supervisor are filling in their agreement about things like salary, and vacations and things like that, because those details are not necessarily clear. And what we have found just in our practice is that lots of conflicts emerge because the students and the supervisors have not clarified things like publications, right? So students get angry, I should have been on this paper and I'm not on this paper, and then the supervisor says, it is my policy that, you know, students always come into the lab and help out on a project and don't get on the paper or whatever. And these details, when the more that these details can be worked out in advance, the more likely it is that these kinds of conflicts can be avoided. That's the rationale for having the contract. And
what's the feedback you generally got from the contract? What,
Josephine, can you comment on that? What is the feedback that we've gotten on the contract? Do you think it's working? Do you think it's helpful?
Yeah. Just as an example, right? Some supervisors will say, I expect 60 hours of work a week. And the student will sign up and say yes. You know? And other supervisors will say, I only expect 35. So at the end, we don't have a student come and say, they want me in on Saturdays. I didn't know this.
Yeah, I didn't know this when I signed up for this. I mean, they know in advance.
The other thing is that they don't have the background. So I expected them to make up. Or lack of background. Well, it's written now that that's the expectation. We used to have supervisors who say, they don't have the background, so I feel I have to think about it.
Is there any concern that
becomes
more like
an employment? I mean,
dealing with, you know,
no, it's more a discussion. It's more a discussion, and the student knows what he or she is getting into from the very beginning. So the student has to accept. And we've had cases where the letter's gone back because the student didn't accept, and they have to keep talking about it.
And again, it's
only
not,
then yeah. do we recommend the student to graduate faculty.
Yeah, and again, it's not a legal document; it's just an agreement. So, all right. I think since it's, oh sure.
It adds flexibility because not every supervisor has the same guidelines, same expectations, etc. So what I tell students is, well, at least you know what the rules are before you get in. And if those rules are broken, then you have a legitimate right. But you have no right to come back and say, well, I didn't expect it to be this way, but you knew what the rules were, and you decided to fight.
All right, so I think that in the interest of getting us into our small group rooms on time, I'm going to stop right here. Are you going to give instructions at this point? Do you have a microphone?
Use the other one.
Okay.
Please join me in thanking David.
Thanks.